I know that you've seen seasonal decorations just as I have at this time of year. And earlier this week, I drove by a house on a street corner. It was in Bella Vista, and it was decorated for Halloween. And as I drove around this particular street corner, you could see the front yard on two sides of this house. It was a bizarre display of zombies and witches and goblins and symbols of the dead, such as gallows and graveyard, spiders, spider webs, and so forth. There were bodies hanging from trees. Someone went to a lot of expense in order to decorate this house for Halloween, which of course stands for Hallowed Evening, which is October 31st, the evening prior to what the Roman Catholics call All Saints' Day. So they call this particular evening, the prior evening, Halloween. At this particular house, there were signs pointing as to where to park if you wanted to visit this haunted house. Well, I haven't visited any haunted houses. Now, I didn't grow up in the church, but I did go to a type of haunted house once. When I was 10 years old, I went with my brother, who was 12 at the time. I was nearly 11. We didn't grow up in the church. We were allowed to go to the Midway or Carnival section of the Minnesota State Fair. And our parents said we had to be at least 10 years old to go to the Carnival section, and we had to stick together, the two brothers. Well, it's a very different time now than it was then. And so children, I don't think, were disappearing quite the same as they are now. So the world appeared to be a bit safer, and the parents said, as long as you stick together. So here we were, almost 11 and at 12 years old, and we were going to explore this great and wondrous, colorful world of the carnival at the state fair. And while my brother and I were touring the carnival, we saw a pirate treasure ship. Now, this was a very big display. The ship rocked from end to end very slightly, not dramatically, but just enough to know there was a continual movement. And this pirate sign said the pirate ship was haunted. Well, we didn't really know what that meant. So we bought our ticket and we entered the portal near the back of the ship, went into the side, and we went down a dark hallway. Well, it was very dark, so to get down the hallway after the entrance, it turned, and we had to feel our way along the hallway. It's all painted black, and we're going down in the dark. I was in front, and my brother was right behind me. Now, we had never been to this kind of a scary haunted house before. We had no idea as to what to expect. And as we inched forward in the dark hallway, I must have triggered some unseen switch, because all at once, several things happened. First of all, jets of air shot up my pants legs from the floor. Well, that was pretty awakening. Secondly, at the same time, a light flashed immediately in front of me, and this light flashing revealed that there were bars on a jail window. So this was right in front of me. And then in this lit jail, these bars, a screaming monkey was slamming up right into the bars, coming right at me within a couple of feet of my face. Well, the effect of the jets blasting up my legs, the flashing light of the jail cell and the screaming monkey in my face caused me, of course, to jump immediately backwards. I landed on the floor on top of my brother. The hissing of the air jets then stopped. The cell window went dark. The monkey disappeared. And I turned to my brother and I said, "I wet my pants." And then I heard something unexpected underneath me. My brother said, "I did too." Now, that was our first and last haunted house experience. Now, this event was nearly 60 years ago. I remember it as vividly as yesterday. Well, the title of today's message is Understanding the Unseen World. Understanding the Unseen World, Comparing the Dark Side to the Light of Truth. Comparing the Dark Side to the Light of Truth. And, of course, the sermonette, Mr. Metzl quoted 2 Timothy 3:15 through 17, which I want to mention that up front, that all Scripture is given for reproof, for doctrine, for reproof and instruction in righteousness. So we're going to go all over the Bible today because that's helpful for those purposes. Well, what do we mean by the unseen world? Well, we live in a physical world where we have five senses, the sense of sight, sound, smell, and taste. And we have the breath of life. Our hearts are beat regularly were warm-blooded creatures with feelings and hopes and dreams and aspirations. We're each born, we have a lifespan, and eventually all die. We're given this opportunity to use this physical life to demonstrate how we can grow, learn, and acknowledge our Creator. Indeed, the Apostle Peter writes in 1 Peter chapter 2 and verse 2 and 1 Peter 2, 2, "As newborn babes, desire the pure milk of the word that you may grow thereby." Just as babies grow by getting milk and then eventually more solid food, we're each supposed to learn the truth as we can and use this life to grow, not just physically. Because, what did Peter say, as newborn babes? So our spiritual lives have to be like that. We need to grow. So we're given an opportunity in this life to learn how to make decisions. And we're allowed to make good decisions and bad decisions. And then we experience the consequences of our decisions. And those consequences could be either blessings or curses. And of course, time and chance happen to all. We read that in Ecclesiastes 9:11. Sometimes we reap the reward of other people's blessings, or we suffer the consequences of other people's mistakes. Sometimes that feels pretty good. Somebody handed you a winning lottery ticket that you didn't buy. You'd feel pretty good about that. But sometimes you get dealt a harsher hand from something that you had no knowledge or decision-making in. So, and this unseen world is a world populated by beings who we generally do not see. So on one hand, we have the angels of light, which we would refer to as the servants of God. And on the other hand, we have demons or the servants of Satan. So first, I want to take a look at the obvious dark side of the world around us. Just like the display on the so-called haunted houses that are replete with witches and vampires, wizards and ghosts, let's see what the Word of God has to say about those manifestations of the dark side. First of all, I want to take a look at the idea of witches. Now, commonly we think of witches as being dressed in black clothing. I think of the actress who labels herself as Elvira. Singer, sometimes we see a witch pictured with a tall, pointed black hat. Perhaps she has a wart on her nose. We see cartoons or pictures of a witch stirring a large iron cauldron that she concocts her witch's brew. And we read that witches put spells on someone, cause them to do a great harm or turn them into something else. In fact, this has been practiced not just for decades or hundreds, but thousands of years. Now, it was in the 1700s, the Emperor of Russia, Peter the Great, brought his huge army eastward to conquer an Eastern European country called Romania. And it was grain harvest season in the summer, and the rye was the chief crop, was the chief grain, and some of the rye was infested with a smut or fungus called ergot. And knowing that the Russians were coming, because it a big army, the word travels fast, that they were on their way, the Romanians harvested the ergot-infested rye first. Now, it's kind of like a dust. In wheat, they call it rust, or in oats, they call it a rust. And they harvested that, and they piled up these stacks of rye, still attached to the stems, into stacks of unthreshed grain. When the Russians arrived, the Romanians welcomed the invading Russian army. And they gave them, said, "Here, welcome. Here are all these stacks of grain. Feel free to use them to make bread." Well, the armies travel, as you know, on their stomachs. So the Russian army was delighted that they didn't have to fight. And they then took the rye grain and they baked it into bread. However, unbeknownst to the Russians, that ergot-infested rye bread was poisoned by that fungus. The ergot contained something called lysergic acid diethylamide. We know this compound as LSD. It's used by druggies to induce hallucinations. It also causes insanity, blindness, sterility, and death. Well, the Russian army ate their freshly baked bread, tasted good, and they suffered greatly. In fact, they suffered so much loss, including the insanity, blindness, and death, that the army was destroyed and the ones remaining alive hobbled back to Mother Russia. Well, this LSD, the ergot in LSD, has been used for thousands of years to cause harm to people and the witches used that to mix up their brews and cast spells on people. So when bad things happened, aha, okay, there was a cause. But there's also a modern mythology that there are good witches, and not just bad witches, you know, the white witches and then the black witches or dark witches. And several television shows popularized the notion of good witches. You might want to turn to Exodus 22, and we'll be there in a moment. Now, some of the TV shows include Bewitched. You may have, older folks will remember that, starring Elizabeth Montgomery. The TV show featured the star's mother, Endora, the witch, and her daughter, Tabitha, a young witch, the girl was, who's a young witch in the making, and then the crazy uncle and absent-minded warlock, which was a male witch. Another TV show was I Dream of Jeannie, starring Barbara Eden. In this case, the witch takes the form of a nice genie in the bottle, a genie who has magical powers. And then there's one that was more recent, one called Charmed, a TV series of modern, everyday, supposedly good witches. And then, of course, there's stories from the book entitled The Tales of Arabian Nights, also called The Thousand and One Nights, where we read about Aladdin and his magic lamp and flying carpet. And the tales have a variety of and geographical range, all in the Mideast area. In fact, the setting is from India and Iran, Iraq, Egypt, and Turkey. Some suggest even as far east or west as Greece. Well, that brings us to Exodus 22, verse 18, about what does God think about witchcraft? And I'm going to read in the Common English Version, and you can read this in several different versions to get the full meaning. In Exodus 22, verse 18, death is the punishment for witchcraft. I think King James may refer to it as sorcery. Well, the goal of Satan is to destroy mankind, physically and spiritually. The goal of Satan is to prevent mankind from inheriting the kingdom of God, and witchcraft is a tool that's used to that end. And practicing witchcraft indeed brings forth death and destruction upon both the practitioner and those who are surrounded with him. If we turn to 1 Samuel 28, we can take a look of what Saul did after the death of Samuel. So if we take a look at 1 Samuel 28, I'm going to jump to it. And we read about this particular story and we'll start in verse 4. The Philistines gathered together and came and encamped at Shunem. And Saul gathered all Israel together, and they encamped at Gilboa. When he says all, meaning all of his troops. When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled. And when Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, either by dreams or by the Urim or by the prophets. And Saul said, now verse 7, Saul said to his servants, find me a woman who is a medium, that I may go to her and inquire of her. And his servants said to him, in fact, there is a woman who is a medium at Endor. And you may note that that TV series about Bewitched had the mother of the star of the show was named Endora. Certainly a play off of this biblical character. Amazing that the people that write the TV shows, somebody must have read the Bible to come up with this. And so, verse 8, Paul disguised himself, went to put on other clothes, and he went out, and two men went with him. Why did two guys go with him? Well, he's the king, and he's in disguise, and, of course, he's at risk, so he's got his bodyguards. And what does he say then? And they came to the woman by night. So there's no street lights on, folks. Nobody can see who it is that's coming. And he said, please conduct a seance for me and bring up for me the one I shall name to you. A seance is, and a medium is someone who purports to consult the dead. A seance is that ceremony by which the medium or the witch will say, you want to talk to a deceased person? Here, I'll arrange that for you. Verse 9, and the woman said to him, look, you know what Saul has done, how he's cut off the mediums and spiritists from the land. Why then don't you lay a snare for my life to cause me to die? She thought it was a trick, and reasonably so, because earlier in his life, Saul was purging the evil from the land, and that includes sending out the mediums and spiritists. So she thought it was a trick. Ha ha, I'm not going to fall for that. You want me to pull up somebody from the dead? And verse 10, and Saul swore to her by the Lord, saying, as the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. And verse 11, the woman said, who shall I bring up for you? And he said, bring up Samuel for me. And when the woman saw Samuel, she cried with a loud voice. And the woman spoke to Saul, saying, why have you deceived me? For you are Saul. Now, how would she know that he was Saul? She had to have had then demons or evil spirits working with her. Did she really consult Samuel? No. Samuel was dead. He was dead all over. Okay. And we all know that no one has ascended to the kingdom except Jesus Christ. And verse 13, the king said to her, do not be afraid. What did you see? And the woman said to Saul, I saw a spirit ascending out of the earth. And he said to her, what is his form? And she said, an old man is coming up, and he's covered with a mantle. And Saul perceived it was Samuel. So she's telling him, he's imagining it. So she's talking, obviously demon-influenced. And so Saul figures out this must be this. He asked for Samuel. It's a case of believing what you want to believe. Verse 15, now Samuel said to Saul, why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? You know, my grandfather was the chairman of the local cemetery board. And I'm going to interrupt on this one because the woman is saying that Saul said, why are you disturbing me? And as such, my grandfather was telling about a cemetery board meeting about the position that they needed to bury people so that they were all facing east and west. And should they put the stones, the marker stones at the head or at the foot? And how should they place them? And there was one fellow there that says, well, you can't put them, you can't position it so that when they rise up out of the dead, they're going to rise up and hit their head on the headstone. I remember as a kid, my grandfather was telling me, I don't know what kind of religion they have, but if you're going to make it through 6 feet of earth, the headstone isn't going to make any difference. So, I mean, he could see through that one, and my grandfather wasn't particularly religious. But we did have to wonder about the fellow who was worried about being resurrected. Now, he did have the idea of resurrection. You got to give him credit for that. So back to verse 15, and of course Saul goes on to explain that he's deeply distressed and so forth, and what should I do? But really I want to take a look here, is that Saul, and we dumped going down to verse 17, and the Lord has done for himself as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David. Because you did not obey the voice of the Lord, nor execute his fierce wrath upon the Amalek, therefore the Lord has done this thing to you this day. In other words, there was consequences. If you're not going to follow God, and you're going to go do these other things, there will be a result. And God's patience is not forever. And he said, well, that's it. That's the limit here. your kingdom will be removed from you and given then to David. So we know that God does not favor the whole idea of witches, and said that death is the punishment for witchcraft. The second category I want to take a look at that's in the Bible is vampires. Saw those depictions on that street corner up in Bella Vista, where you have the characters. Now, when we think of vampire, we usually think of Bela Lugosi in a 1931 movie that he had about Dracula. And that's where we get this modern day picture of what a vampire looks like. He's got the black cloak with the upturned collar, a pasty white or even a greenish complexion. And because he's not composed or exposed to sunlight. One source I read said that, oh man, a vampire is all done if he gets more than 10 seconds of direct sunlight. So I thought, well, man, who's timing that? And of course, part of the picture is that he's got to have sharp pointed fangs in order to puncture skin and draw blood. Well, the vampires are often characterized as a bat, which is a winged creature, a little mammal that comes out only at night and flies around, living off the blood of its victims. And interestingly, that vampires are presented as almost being immortal, because unless they look into a mirror or get exposed to sunlight or get stabbed in the heart with an oak stake or shot with a silver bullet. Now, there are mythical versions of vampires, such as werewolves, that only come out at night and especially during a full moon. I know teachers have often gathered in the faculty lunchroom and said, "Think it's a full moon. Your students doing the same thing in your room as they're doing in mine?" Which is the explanation as to why this strange behavior coming around by these kinds of werewolf-type behavior. In Leviticus 7, starting in verse 26, in Leviticus 7, 26, of course, vampires survive or live on blood. So when we read Leviticus 7, verse 26 and verse 27, what do we read in the instructions? And I'm going to read this in the English Standard Version. "Moreover, you shall eat no blood whatsoever, whether of fowl or of animal, in any of your dwelling places. Whoever eats any blood, that person shall be cut off from his people." Well, what have we read earlier? What's the expectation? What's the whole goal for the demonic world? Is to displace humanity from having an opportunity to join the kingdom of God. And this is just another way to directly contradict what God says. So when you see the depictions of vampires, you know it's directly contra-biblical. The third category are wizards. We turn to Deuteronomy 18, starting in verse 10. In Deuteronomy 18, starting in verse 10, I do want to read through that one. "There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or daughter pass through the fire." Now, of course, we've spoken of that earlier, about sacrificing your children to Molech, a pagan Canaanite god. And then the next phrase, "or who practices witchcraft, or a soothsayer, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer." Verse 11, "or one who conjures up spells, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead." Well, we just saw that previously, but let's take a look in verse 11, a spiritist. And if we take a look in the King James Version, in verse 11, it says, "or a charmer or consulter with familiar spirits, or a wizard or a necromancer." Well, that's a big word, a Greek word, the modern English comes out of Greek. And what is necromancy? It's the supposed practice of communicating with the dead, especially in order to predict the future. And so you have those in the dark arts where they're going to have a medium who's looking into a crystal ball, and then you're supposed to supposedly be able to look into the crystal ball and see the future. And yet what does it say in Deuteronomy 18? There shall not be found any among you who practices these things. So we get the idea that there's a problem here. Synonyms for necromancy, the black arts, witchcraft, wizardry, the occult, occultism, enchantment, spell, incantation, divination, voodooism or voodoo, witching, medicine, shamanism, that's interesting, medicine, thaumaturgy, thurgy, witchery, and demonry. So all of those interesting words, various synonyms. We read on in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 12. We read in Deuteronomy 18 and verse 12, "For all who do these things are an abomination to the Lord, and because of these abominations, the Lord your God drives them out from before you." Now, the children of God cannot exist and coexist and thrive with abominations. With the Israelites, when the Israelites came to the promised land, the land of Canaan, they were instructed not to adopt demonic practices of the local people. To prevent the mixing of God's people with demon worship, God removed the people who had taken over the land during the 430-year absence of the Israelites. So let's take a look now in Isaiah 8, starting in verse 18. In Isaiah 8, starting in verse 18, I'm going to read this in the New King James. Isaiah 8:18, For the Lord spoke thus to me with a strong hand and instructed me that I should not walk in the way of his people, saying, verse 19, And when they say to you, Seek those who are mediums and wizards who whisper and mutter, should not a people seek their God? Should they seek the dead on behalf of the living? To the law and to the testimony, if they do not speak according to this word, it is because there is no light in them. Well, God told us not to get involved with those mediums and wizards. And don't say you're doing it because you're wanting to get a better knowledge of God, to relate it to him, because there is what? No light in them, no truth in them. So we've taken a look now at the at this third category called wizards. Fourth category I want to address are ghosts. Surely everyone has heard the term ghosts. We commonly think of it as an apparition or an evanescent appearance. You know, it comes and then it goes. According to the Bing.com online dictionary, a ghost is an apparition of a dead person, which is believed to appear or become manifest to the living, typically as a nebulous image. There's not a lot of clear, necessarily, outlines to it. We often see depictions of ghosts like being with a white bedsheet over a person, then they disappear and reappear again. In fact, it's so common, people's worry about ghosts, that their real estate requires you to file a disclaimer or a disclosure, I should say, if the house is haunted. Did somebody die in the house? Means the body is gone and the spirit is still there, so to speak. So they have to say, what is the history of the house in the real estate world? In the 1950s, there was a TV show, comedy show, a half-hour show called Topper. And the series was about a somewhat grumpy and uptight banker named Topper, Cosmo Topper, and the ghosts which only he could see or hear. And, well, we didn't have television in the home where I was growing up until I was nearly out of high school. And I remember seeing an episode of Topper at my grandparents' home. And I was amazed. Seeing somebody on television walk through a wall was really quite something to me and very memorable. And, of course, most of us will remember or know of a cartoon or a comic series called Casper the Ghost. And then there's an early popular video game, game called Pac-Man that has ghost-like creatures. We even hear some Bible translators refer mistakenly to the Holy Ghost. And Leviticus 19 and verse 31 gives us a little more clarity. In Leviticus 19 and verse 31, and again I'm going to read from the English Standard Version, in Leviticus 19 and verse 31. Do not turn to mediums or necromancers. Do not seek them out, and so make yourselves unclean by them. I am the Lord your God. The Common English Version says it this way. Don't make yourselves disgusting to me by going to people who claim they can talk to the dead. Now, I've had the experience of talking to church members who've had some bad experiences like this. And I can't go too deep into it, but they said somebody showed up, or what I thought was, but it was kind of a wavy person, you know, this being. What should I do? Which is pretty scary to know that you're being directly attacked by something that you doesn't have a real firm form, which they could often refer to as a ghost. So we don't even want to be close or have anything to do with those kinds of experiences. We're repeatedly admonished by the written word of God to recognize evil and to avoid it. Or repeatedly told by God to have nothing to do with witches and vampires, wizards or ghosts, or anyone who aligns themselves with such things. And yet, while we know there's a dark side of the unseen world, we who are Christians are also aware of a very different unseen world, a world which is inhabited by spirit beings who follow and worship God. And the Holy Spirit, or the Holy Scriptures, give us a glimpse of what that world is like. Now, I'm going to turn in a moment to Genesis 18, but I want us to bear in mind that evil spirits do not have bodies of their own. They must inhabit an actual physical being. And this is in contrast to angels of truth who can manifest themselves as physical. But you can say, well, yeah, but we're looking at all of these other creatures. Well, these evil spirits are inhabiting an existing body. In fact, speaking to my niece, who is lived halfway between us and her dad, and in case something bad happened, where would be the nearest place to go? And she's, 300 miles from each one of us. And the young lady says, where am I going to go in case of a national emergency? And I said, well, we have food and a wood stove and a river for water. And she turns to my brother and says, Dad, in case of a zombie apocalypse, I'm going to go live with Uncle Tim. Now, the young people all know about this whole idea or concept of a zombie apocalypse. In fact, the closest we have is we grew up hearing the Frankenstein story about a dead person who is now now walking around. And what's causing them to do that would be a zombie inhabited by an evil spirit. So this is, and we also read, and I'm not turning there for a matter of time, but there were evil spirits in many places in the Bible. One is Christ cast out demons in a number of cases, but he cast them in one case into a herd of swine who then went and ran into the sea and drowned. So we have this, they must inhabit an existing body of some kind, which is why we want to keep them away from us. Let's take a look at a very different kind of spirit in Genesis 18. And this is the story of where Abraham entertained angels. So let me jump into Genesis 18. And if we go through this story, in Genesis 18, the Lord appeared to him by the terebinth trees of Mamre, and as he was sitting in the tent door in the heat of the day, verse 2, he lifted up his eyes, and behold, there were three men standing by him, and when we saw them, he ran from the tent to meet them, and bowed himself to the ground, and said, My Lord, if I have now found favor in your sight, do not pass on by your servant. Please, let a little water be washed, brought, wash your feet, rest yourselves under the tree. I'll bring you a morsel of bread, that you may refresh your hearts, and that you may pass by, inasmuch as you've come to your servant. And they said, Do as you've said. And he goes through this whole, so he's entertaining. And as it turns out, they're explaining to him that his wife Sarah will be having fertility cycles and indeed conceive a son. And that's when we read that Sarah laughed. And yet Isaac was born sometime later, despite her otherwise being past the age of childbearing. And we keep on reading, and this is where it is revealed that they are on their way to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah. We read verse 22, or verse 20, and the Lord said, Abraham said, Why? And he said, Because the outcry against Sodom and Gomorrah is great, and because their sin is very grave. And so now Abraham begins to bargain. Now, to bargain back and forth. And as you'll notice it says three, but then you go through the bargaining process. In verse 19, it says, Now the two angels came to Sodom in the evening, and Lot was sitting in the gate. Wait a minute, there were three before, and now there's two. What happened? Well, the commentaries that I've read, several commentaries suggest that the God of the Old Testament, Jesus Christ, was that third person manifesting then, and yet only two angels went on to carry out the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. And so you have this experience there where Abraham entertained angels, and clearly they could eat, they could drink, they could manifest themselves as if they were human. We then have another occurrence in Numbers 22. And in Numbers 22, let me turn to that one. And this is a story of Balaam. We'll get there. So in Numbers 22, the children of Israel moved and camped in the plains of Moab on the side of the Jordan across from Jericho. So they were on the eastern side of the Jordan River. Verse 3, and Moab was exceedingly afraid of the people because they were many. And Moab was sick with the dread because of the children of Israel. And they were worried. They said, we're going to be licked bad here. We're going to be wiped out. Whatever should we do? And we read on in verse 4, and Balak the son of Zippor was king of the Moabites at the time, and he sent messengers to Balaam to call him, saying, look, a people has come from Egypt. They cover their face. They cover the face of the earth. Means there's lots of them. There's so many, we can't really count them. And they're settling next to me. Come at once. Curse the people. So he's asking, the king of Moab is saying to Balaam, please curse the people for me, because they're too mighty for me. And so I shall be able to defeat them and drive them out of the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. Well, that's pretty big. He recognizes that there's something about this Balaam fellow that says when you bless, when you've blessed them, they've been blessed. When you cursed, they've been cursed. And what does Balaam say? If we look in verse 8, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Lord speaks to me. So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. And verse 9, and God came to Balaam and said, who are these men with you? And Balaam went on to explain the situation. In verse 12, God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. Now, what did we learn earlier about all of these other strange, or these other, so we talked about whether they're practitioners of the dark side. Don't go to them. Don't involve yourself with them. Stay away from them. They're on the dark side. And what did God say to Balaam? Don't go with them. Don't curse the people, for they are blessed. So Balaam rose in the morning and said, go back home. Go back to your land. The Lord has refused to give me permission to go with you. Well, this was a problem, of course, because if there's a king, who's going to disagree with the king, right? You're supposed to do what the king says. And that's really the story. So the king asks again. And promises him a great reward. And so in verse 18, and Balaam said to the servants of the king of Balak, although Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the word of the Lord my God to do less or more. So he said, but you can stay here and then I'll ask God again. Who knows? Maybe something different will come up. And that's in verse 20. And if the men call, and God came to Balaam at night and said, if the men come to call you, rise and go with them, but only the word which I speak to you that you shall do. So we go up, verse 21. Balaam saddled rose in the morning, saddled his donkey, and went with the princes of Moab. So God didn't tell him to, had warned him about going with those people and speaking to them in a particular way. And God's anger was aroused, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as an adversary against him. So the angel of the Lord is stopping Balaam from going further. Balaam couldn't see it. He didn't have any evidence that there was an angel standing there. But we read on, and he was riding his donkey, and his two servants were with him. Verse 23, and now the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And the donkey turned aside out of the way and went into the field. Now, I've raised cattle and horses and sheep, and I remember growing up on the farm. There's a cattle were running and you stood in the way, they would generally go around, avoid you and go around you. So if you were standing in the road, that was blocking them, they would go off to the side and go into the field. And that's indeed what was happening here. The donkey was trying to go around this. The donkey recognized that there was a problem. And verse 24, and the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on this side and a wall on that side. So it's a narrow way. Donkey can't really go around. And in verse 25, the donkey saw the angel of the Lord. She pushed herself against the wall and crushed Balaam's foot against the wall, so he struck her again. In other words, really trying to squeeze by here, trying to please the guy that's riding. You know, the donkey's trying to please the master, Balaam, who's riding him, but, you know, trying to avoid the angel in the road with a sword. But verse 25, when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pushed herself against the wall, crushed Balaam's foot, so he struck her again. Well, you got to get this thing moving here. Hit the donkey on the backside, that'll propel it forward. Riders with a horse, they have something called a quirt, which is a short whip, and you'll see it on races where they will give a snap on the rump of the horse to make him feel some pain behind him, and they'll go faster. They'll go forward. On the farm with livestock for loading cattle, we use 5D batteries and about a 3-foot prod and give them a little electric jolt. And then they get motivated to go forward. So I would say this is sort of the equivalent here, that Balaam is striking the donkey to motivate the donkey to go forward. And verse 26, the angel of the Lord went further and stood in a narrow place, no way to turn either to the left or to the right. So verse 27, the donkey lays down. That's it. It has nowhere to go. It can't go forward. It can see what's going on. And then something remarkable happens. Verse 28, and the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey. And the donkey says to Balaam, what have I done to you that you have struck me these 3 times? Now, I've never had a donkey speak to me. I've never had a cow or a horse or any animal for that matter. I've had cats purr and dogs growl and sheep bleat and chickens squawk. I've never had them talk to me. So that would have set me back right off the bay. But God opened the donkey's mouth. And verse 29, Balaam said to the donkey, because you've abused me, I wish there were a sword in my hand, for now I would kill you. Balaam was really angry. Donkey wouldn't go forward, and it crushed his foot against the wall. Now it lies lying down. So the donkey, verse 30, says to Balaam, am I not your donkey on which you have ridden ever since I became yours to this day? Have I ever disposed you to do this, to you? And what did Balaam say? Well, no. So it's an out-of-character experience. Verse 31, the Lord opened Balaam's eyes, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. What did Balaam do? He bowed his head and fell flat on his face. You notice the angel of the Lord was manifested to Balaam. Before the donkey was the only one that could see. Now Balaam himself could see this, could see that his way was blocked. Sometimes we don't see how our way is blocked. We just try to stumble on, our foot gets crushed. Or, you know, bad things are happening. I'm going to have to make better choices next time. We don't see the way of the Lord that's blocking us. So we have this manifestation here that to Balaam, who blocked, whose way was blocked by the angel of the Lord. And we can go on and read the rest of the story, but the point here is that an angel of light, the angel of the Lord, was manifested himself to Balaam. We have this, and then we have the story in 2 Kings 6. And I do want to take a look at 2 Kings 6. Let me jump to it. In 2 Kings 6, we have a situation that involves the prophet Elisha. And if we read to read down to let's start in verse 11. The heart of the king of Syria was greatly troubled, and he called his servants and said to them, "Will you not show which of us is for the king of Israel?" And one of his servants said, "None, my lord, O king, but Elisha the prophet, who's in Israel, tells the king of Israel the words you speak in your bedroom." Ooh. How many of us want our words that we speak to be broadcast as if in a megaphone or on a tape recording and heard somewhere else? Of course, none of us would ever say anything that no one else would ever want to hear, right? So, but yet, that had to be discomforting to the king of Syria. Elisha the prophet knows everything about you. Well, Elisha doesn't know it, but through the Spirit of God. But he's the one that's speaking it. And so what does the king of Syria say in verse 13? "Go and see where he is, that I may send and get him." And we go on in verse 14, "He sent horses and chariots and a great army there and surrounded the city." And verse 15, "And the servant of the man of God," meaning Elisha's servant, "arose early and went out, and there was an army surrounding the city with horses and chariots. And his servant said to him, 'Alas, my master, what shall we do?'" What does Elisha say in verse 16? Now, can you imagine waking up from your motel room and there are thousands of military surrounding you, whether it's tanks, personnel carriers, artillery, surrounded the whole city because they're looking for you or the guy you're working for, the guy that you are helping out. And what does Elisha say in verse 16? "Do not fear, for those who are with us are more than those who are with them." Doesn't that sound odd? Remember, we read earlier that Elisha knew what the king was saying in his private chambers. And yet God had given great insight and knowledge and understanding to Elisha. Verse 17, "And Elisha prayed, and Lord, I pray, open his eyes," meaning the servant, "that he may see. Then the Lord opened the eyes of the young man, and he saw, and behold, the mountain was full of horses and chariots of fire all around Elisha." Elisha could see it. He was gifted with a double measure of the Spirit of God. Yet his servant did not have his eyes open to the unseen world. And guess who else couldn't see those unseen army of horses and chariots that were protecting Elisha? Verse 18. "So when the Syrians came down to him, Elisha prayed to God and said, 'Strike these people, I pray, with blindness.' And he," meaning God, "struck them with blindness according to the word of Elisha." Took care of it. That was it. "Now Elisha says to them, 'This is not the way, nor is this the city. Follow me, and I will bring you to the man whom you seek.' And he led them to Samaria. And the Lord said," verse 20, "Elisha said, 'Lord, open the eyes of these men that they may see.' And the Lord opened their eyes, and they saw that they were inside Samaria." He took them somewhere else. "You're in the wrong place. Let me show you where you really need to go. And it's certainly not here." Now, I wanted to give those examples of the unseen world. And these are just but a few. And perhaps there'll be a part two that will go through other examples in the Bible of this unseen world, where there's a dark side of the world. There is the side that we've reviewed that is about witches and vampires. We have wizards and ghosts, and into that you can fit all of the other characters, whether it's goblins and werewolves and all the other dark side creatures. And then what do we have? We have the angels of the Lord, the angels of light, who can manifest themselves physically, whereas the other side has to work through existing bodies. So while we are aware that there is this dark side, and that as Christians, we also must continually be aware of a very different unseen world, the world inhabited by the spirit beings who follow and worship God. Will we always see them? Can we be good servants of Elisha as he had? But we don't always see these things. But we can have the faith to know that God protects us, he provides for us, and he can use that his spirit and his angels to confound those who fight against us. So we have this opportunity here, as this season is, as this Halloween season is, to understand the unseen world.